due to weather, but if the weather didn't permit us to get it, we had to do the best we could. Yeah. We always recorded what we were doing.
Yeah.
So there's no question about it. When they got their films, we recorded the height it was taken at and any other details they'd asked for.
Were they similar focal lengths, the old and the new camera? This would have some effect on the technique.
No, I think the American camera was completely different to the British one. And but we had the detail. I've got in my logbook the Neon Frontier Fairchild. I remember carrying him from Ottawa. I went out on a different job altogether, and they asked me if I'd take him because I'd been flying the Havilland. I was the only pilot there at the time that they could detail or ask him. So I took him and I carried him from Ottawa to Petawawa and let him photograph up and down the Ottawa River to test the camera. And he was the expert from the Fairchild factory who had come to Ottawa to look it into. I'll have his name in my logbook.
Good.
Well, any questions on that?
Was the work substantially the same as in High River?
The world had progressed by that time. See, the work in High River had been entirely with the old British cameras.
Well, I mean, were you doing forest patrols to the same extent surveying to the same extent?
I would say that gradually doing photography for mapping increased as the years went by. In the beginning, we were chiefly forestry patrol, Indian work, and some minimal photography. And later on, year by year, mapping became more and more important. And by the 30s, we had the detachments going right down to the Arctic and all up through the Hudson's Bay,
Did you do any pioneering in photographic techniques?
I wouldn't go as far as call it exactly pioneering, but really, actually, in that single seater that we designed, we put our own radio in it. You see, our own the pilot. We dispensed with the observer altogether, the DH-4A.
That was at High River.
Yes, that was only on a land plane.
Yes,
because you wouldn't do that quite the same on the other plane. So we dispensed with it, and we handled our own camera. We handled our own wireless, and in those days, you had to with the wireless, you had to let an aerial out.
Yes.
Let it out.
And remember to haul it back in when you land.
Well, you had to be very careful in letting it out, because if you let it go, you'd be going so fast that it just took off and then departed, and you didn't have any aerial. So after a few times losing the aerial, you weren't very popular. You weren't very happy about it. So you had to wind it up very carefully, and then you had to remember to wind it in, because if you came back to try to land with it, you found it wound around the farmer's fence or around the tree half a mile or a mile away, and you had to go and find it.
What about the flying boats and technique?
I don't think so. We were chiefly concerned with building ramps and slipways in the wilderness. We learned more about trying to build ramps. Our aircraft by that time had become better. The Vickers Viking. That's one we used mostly from 23 to 27. I was using it mostly. I flew the others, the HS2L, and we used one of Stedman's converted Avros. He'd put a stationary engine in the wretched thing and put it on floats. Killed several of our young pilots. It could be flown, but it needed a very, to be thoroughly skilled in handling it and be able to understand its limitations, where our young pilots couldn't get it through their heads. You told them all about it, but I know I've had to bury several of our young pilots do it. The Avro was there. But then you see the Canadian government wouldn't buy any new machine, and poor Stedman had to do his best to produce something, so don't blame Stedman and the Stedman company. The government wouldn't buy any new machine. We were still in that same boat right after the war, broke out in War II, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
We had a few new machines, but very few.
I know. Well,
a few new aircraft.
What about winter operations?
Yes, the winter operations, very much the same as I said about the photography. In the beginning, skis were new. We didn't know too much about them, and no one else knew very much about them. I think Canada probably made early progress there, as much progress as anywhere in the world, the use of skis. To my knowledge, I don't know of any other country that was in at all as early as Canada. If you look in the records, you'll find that some of the RFC pilots that stayed in Canada and didn't go to Texas that winter had actually tried out skis at Camp Borden. And they were the first, to my knowledge, to ever put a land plane on skis. And that was, it would be the winter of 1718. Now, from that, work went on again every year at Camp Borden. And then we did some of it later. That knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Seek that.
Mm-hmm. What we don't have any information about is the routine that you would follow in winter.
Well, I'll give you a rough idea. But the routine would be different in different parts of Canada.
Yeah.
So,
but at High River in this
Winnipeg,
period...
High River in Winnipeg, was I also went to High... I spent a month or so back at Borden to do different jobs in that period. So I saw both the,
yes,
both sides. But the High River, very little the first winter. The second winter, we got skis on and we're using.
Mm-hmm.
But again, several winters there was not enough snow, mm-hmm, to keep you from using wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And you would fly off the aerodrome with wheels several winters. We didn't have a lot of skis. I don't remember more than one aircraft being on skis. About one aircraft.
And what about daily routines in the winter? Would it be...
Chiefly overhaul.
I see.
Chiefly overhaul. There's a tremendous work of, a tremendous amount of work to do with all these aircraft.
Yes.
By the time,
yeah.
And we all learned to, they were all covered, the wings were covered with linen. But if you wanted a new coat of, a new overcoat for your aircraft, the next year you better get busy in the wintertime and make it. So we all learned to sew our own wings and dope them, and we had so many coats of dope. We found out exactly the right number to put on. If you put on too many, it became too heavy. If you didn't put on enough, it wouldn't stand the weather. So again, men like Tony Radnett, Wing Commander Radnett now, was the brain that guided the Surrey pilots along. They also showed us how to do our sewing. And we did it.
Sailmaking.
Sailmaking.
Right.
Knots. Now all the rest of it, he gave us the instruction. There was a good program of work.
Did you enjoy that?
Well, yes, it was interesting. In fact, when I go upstairs, I'll show you my first smoking stand that I made while I was at High River. Radnett gave me a few rough ideas. You do all sorts of work.
And one other question about this period. How many staff did you have and pilots did you have at Norway House?
Three or four. Three with experience, and usually if they had a fourth one there that required training, he'd be sent in and you'd have him. Three or four.
Oh yeah, and other staff besides pilots?
Oh yeah, that's what you had there.
Yeah, what size?
I'd say about 15 to 20. In mm-hmm. other ranks, 24, depending on the type of aircraft you had.
And the area you covered in Manitoba, was that the whole from the Hudson's Bay?
Yes, the whole of Manitoba.
Yes.
But that was only for the Manitoba government. Anything that you wanted that the federal government wanted, the other departments of government, for example, my photography along Churchill River by the Department of Interior model, not to the government. We worked in part for the government of Manitoba, but we were also doing work all the time. The Department of Interior was Ottawa, from Ottawa. The Department of Interior, which embraced so much at that time as compared to I don't know what to call them all now, but there are half a dozen different departments in there.
How did you decide who to give priority to?
Oh, well, the weather was the chief factor. Yeah. You knew your slate of work. There was your slate of work. And if it was a photographic job, you grabbed your photography, whether it's Saturday or Sunday or Monday, and 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 4 o'clock in the morning. It didn't make a particle of difference to know that during operations from spring until freeze-up, no one ever worried about Sundays or Mondays or whatever day. The weather, there were some priority. But actually, if it had been raining like the devil, the forest fires weren't going to be causing a great deal of trouble. And as soon as it cleared, photography was number one, whereas if the smoke was all over, you couldn't photograph anyway. I mean, that's a crude analysis, but you yourself decide. Ottawa will tell you the priority, but then what the devil could they do in Ottawa in telling you that you had to do it if the weather wouldn't permit?
Right. Well, you went to Camp Borton from Manitoba.
Yes, I did. The Croix wasn't there when I arrived. I told you it was Edmonton Croix. Bednar was there, and then Anderson, briefly. Anderson got married, and he went away somewhere, and then Croix came.
And what was the general organization? Could you tell us something of the organization and routine of training?
Well, at that time, is the only time, to my knowledge, during those early years, where the Air Force commanded, had a senior officer commanding, and he also had a signal unit in there that came under us as Camp Commandant.
Oh, yes.
So the only time in Canada in those early years that where the Air Force were the
signature. Air Force took charge of the Army.
That's right. Yeah. And they were very happy the signals were there, because we'd done a good job for the signals. See, the signals weren't in existence at all until they came to us at High River and put our... We had the... I think it was the RNAS, the Navy had the signals in there first in 1921. But in 1922, we switched. And Colonel Steele, he's Lieutenant Colonel Steele, and he was under Colonel Ford. And Steele came out there with a man by the name of Hastings, and they were the two and it is from the experience that the Army got there in handling our signals at the forest branch. We were getting signals back there up to 140 to 180 miles. And the radius of the wireless that was used in France has been pretty limited. Now, this is a great extension. And Steele was tremendously enthused about it, and he got back to Ottawa, and by that time the Canadian government was just about to open up a wireless arrangement in the north of Canada, and the Canadian, that's where the signals got their great boost in going to the north of Canada, as well as their work with us.
Yeah.
So there was always a very happy relationship between the signals and the Army.
Did you look forward to going back to Borden and the more military role, or did this have any particular bearing on your feelings?
Well, you never asked in those days. That might apply to anyone in the service now, but it didn't apply then.
Wasn't a question of asking so much, sir, but
they sort of
subjectively, was it a relief to you that at last you're going back to a...
Oh, no. No. I was very happy. I was very happy in Borden.
Yeah.
Equally happy.
Yeah.
I don't say I was unhappy. I was never particularly unhappy anywhere that I remember. There's a job to do. It's usually interesting.
Yeah. Was it a more military atmosphere, Borden?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. If there was a plus in going back to Borden, we'd still have the remnants of the old... fighters there, and I was able to fly a fighter aircraft again in the Siskin and various other ones. And then I didn't stay too long. I was able to get off in just over a year. And the last part of my time there, the year, I commanded the war fighter, the Siskins, and everything else. In fact, I led the Siskin team. I was a senior officer on Saturday, didn't I get to see them there, the two. One of the ones, Dave Harding, you probably know about Dave Harding, the great football player.
Oh, yes.
Well, he was one of the the pilot, and Victor Demas was an RAF, young, much younger than either Harding or myself. He was out in an exchange, and he'd been flying systems in England, so he fitted in very nicely with the team, and we went to, we flew that year in 1929, we were flown 28 to Hamilton and Toronto, 1929. Now, this has not been formed. There was no official. We just had our own jobs, but whenever they'd ask for a demonstration flight, they'd go to Waterloo, come down to us, send them if they can. Well, of course, we always made an effort and got there if we could. And that year, they'd asked for us to go to Cleveland in addition. So we'd flown in Hamilton, London, Brantford, somewhere, not Windsor, but the place just south of Windsor. In the vicinity of Windsor, anyway.
Sarnia.
Could have been anyway, and then we went on to Cleveland. And Redner was the chief of the air staff. And J.A. Wilson was the head of the and he'd been one that we'd worked with very. I flew J.A. Wilson time and time again at High River when he come out there to get us different jobs of work to do. J.A. Wilson, wonderful man. He wasn't part.
No, I
don't. A wonderful person, very likable.
He was a great friend to the Air Force.
Oh, well, we adored him.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were there. They came to Cleveland to see the show, and I remember that we got in late the night before, and we were having breakfast in the hotel, and Bredner came down and came over and joined us, and I looked up, and after he got his first cup of coffee, I said, "Well, what do you want us to do today?" And he looked me square in the eye and he said, "Well, George, I want you to do your stuff." I said, "Well, you know, that means a pretty open order." He said, "Not necessarily. I don't want any crashes." I said, "Well, anything short of crashes." "Within reason, yes." Well, those are my instructions. Well, we'd fitted belly tanks to these damn Siskins so that we'd fly them upside down, and we'd been practicing inverted flying. Now, inverted flying in England had been going on for quite a while. I'd flown inverted in England before I left there in 21. That's one of the things. Oh, yes, there was a very good inverted pilot long before I was. Draper, Armstrong were South African, and Draper was an Englishman. They were flying inverted.
Not the Mad Major.
Yeah, the Mad Major. Oh. Two out of the bridges.
Yeah.
Chris Draper.
Yeah.
Mad as Harry.
Yeah.
He flew under off and down the Thames, over one and under the other. But he could fly. He was a good pilot. Oh, that's when, and so was Armstrong. But coming back to Cleveland, we were due to go on 3 o'clock in the afternoon to Siskins, and you had to crank the other half. The no self starter. You had to get out and heave. The mechanics had to heave them. You were sitting in the pilot, but. We were due to go on 3 o'clock, and it was quite hot in September, first week in September, first week in September, 29. And then out once we were told, "No, please turn off your engines. Lindbergh is coming in." He'd been flown over in 27, but he'd been leading it, and the Marines were going to lead him in. And Geiger was the Colonel Geiger, he was Major Geiger then, Colonel Geiger, Major Colonel later. And also the great Geiger in the west of the Pacific. He's a major, the full 4-star general. So that's when I first met him, 29, and he was in charge of the Marines in Quantico.
I see.
Well, they were the men, but we had to sit there for about 30 minutes or engine off, for 40 minutes or more. Well, God, we knew if these engines got hot, they wouldn't start again. And we were furious, but they fed us good corn whiskey. And we took off. As a very strong wind blowing, and the seats, the grandstands were up facing Lake Erie. The lake, the winds were coming in right off the lake. Instead of going away back and taking off, we simply let them sit right where they were. And the Siskin would take off the ground almost in no steps at all, and then we just ease like that. And there's 100,000 in the stands. We were facing them. We never crossed the stands. We simply climbed to 2,000 feet just there, right in front of them. So they all stood up, but these damned aircraft coming right at them. Redner, he said, "I didn't ask you to do that." Later. But then when we got to about 2,000 feet, we simply turned them upside down, and we'd stay about 50 seconds upside down, and then about oh, 15 seconds back on your belly again, make sure that your engines are not, all, pipes are not oiling up or anything else. And they didn't sit down all the time we're there. We got the first prize, and I got a bag upstairs now. I was giving them the silly cream. The first prize was a three of us got a, what do you call it, handbag. It's up there. Yeah. I haven't got the belt on. He got a belt also for aerobatics. Got a 1921 Navin silver dollar in the front of it.
Have you? That'll have a tremendous value.
Well, some of
that'll. One of the things that happened in this period was the flying club courses.
Ah, that is tremendous.
Yes.
Not at that period so much. That didn't start until, well, excuse me, if the start had been there, but the impetus on it took place in the early 30s. When we got to England, our staff college, mm-hmm. the end of 29, and I was over there, and then that's where I began to bump into more and more to what we call the Trenchard team. It was Trenchard, the one that I was mostly very close to, became very close friends, was James Robb. He was Air Chief Marshal, he named Job in the end, after the war, but he was then at Staff College, he was a squadron leader, wing commander, and later. They had made up their mind that they were not going to get anything out of McDonald. See, McDonald took over, McDonald's election was in 29, Ramsey McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
And straight away, by 30 and 31, they were satisfied, they were with it. And as the years went by, how completely right Trenchard was, that you won't get too much on a military basis. They didn't get them too much later either, but get on with helping the flying clubs, because they're going to have required flying instructors. Who's going to train them? Were the only people in the world who got that training, or in the country. They will require mechanics to look after their aircraft. Who's going to train them? We will. And they'll have to give us some aircraft to do that training. Now, we started that in Canada. As early as 1932, I got stuck on it myself, whether I liked it or not. In fact, I was on civil operations in El Alto when I first came back from 31 and 2, I think.
Mm-hmm.
31 and 2, I was on civil operations with Air Force headquarters. And then I went to Toronto the early 33, and I was there for the best part of 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And by that time, not insisted that I go down there. But my chief job was to set up non-permanent squadrons, auxiliary squadrons,
yeah.
Just the same as the militia squadrons.
That was a later period.
Yes, but I'm coming back to that. That's
yes.
When this thing took emphasis.
Yes.
The great effort there, and by the end of 37, 38, we had some 34 clubs, flying clubs, either booked or on the books or going,
yeah.
And we had some eight or ten squadrons. So that great impetus mm-hmm. took place in the 30s, and not to my knowledge, not too much in the early years.
Well, the Department of National Defense did in about 1929 start the flying club movement. But as you say,
the department, this is the A. Wilson, you see, had all the flying clubs yeah. before that. And I think he had them all the way through. The,
yeah.
We never commanded them in any way, but we had a liaison job with them.
You didn't really, in your 27-29 period, have much of this. It was later.
What we had to do for the flying club, they were frequently a nuisance because they had no inspectors at all of their own in those earlier days.
Ah.
And every time there'd be a crash, the Air Force had to go out and sit on the Court of Inquiry. And I remember one crash at Niagara Falls when I was at Camp Borden, and I had to go there for a weekend, over a weekend, and hold a court of inquiry. And I didn't want to have parties in Toronto, I wanted to attend. But I got there, and Gordon Sinclair was on the Toronto Star at that time, in the 29. And he was one of the reporters that were trying to get news. Well, we certainly weren't going to hold our court of inquiry. It shows everything open, you know. So I said, all right, so we'll hold the court of inquiry at 3 o'clock this afternoon in the, what do they call the Brock Hotel in Niagara Falls?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so then I got the court together, and I said, now you bastards, you can go up separately by yourselves at 10 o'clock and 10:30, and we'll meet under the wing of the airport, and we'll do our court of inquiry, but everything will be sealed and signed, and it'll just be a, so, but they got at 3 o'clock, it's pretty short and sweet.
That must have been the St. Catherine's Flying Club.
It could have been.
Which later on you became
associated. Beautiful. But I don't recall that the field was right in Niagara Falls. And St. Catherine's had a different field altogether. It was near the old bombing school of War I.
Oh, now, from Borden you went to the Staff College.
Yes.
I've interviewed Air Vice Marshal Godfrey at some length, and he has rather positive feelings about the RAF and about England, one way. Did you come back with any feelings about the RAF, and was there any interest in the Canadian Air Force over there?
Oh, well, as far as you are concerned, we had no staff college in Canada at all. That level of thinking, that level of doing, was completely, well, it was a godsend since we did get into the war. Without it, we'd have been absolute neophytes.
Yeah.
Syria.
Yeah.
And we had, we always had an exchange of one or two or more RAF officers out here and one or two or more of ours over there. We constantly sent our own people there year after year to their different schools. The ones that I had attended, I admit the schools were quite new in 1919 and 1920, mm-hmm. early 21.
Mm-hmm.
They were new, but they were still the schools that had been functioning at the end of World War I. And there was nothing comparable, as I mentioned a minute ago, in the world.
That's right.
And as far as any feeling between the two, I would think that the feeling was excellent. I never found any feeling.
Tommy Lawrence says that in the 30s, he felt that as a Canadian, he wasn't accepted in the RAF. He was the military RAF attaché.
Yeah.
And he felt that he was not getting the reception from the RCAF. That
much depended on you. I had no problem, none of them. I had very good friends, and I still have there. No, I never felt that way. I think you had to cut the mustard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't use that phrase, but
why not? I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
I had no problem, not at all. I liked them very much. Reg, excuse me, if you'd like to find a drink over there, by all means, help yourself. May I?
Well, shall I turn this off and turn the tape over?
Right.
No, it's not as special. I'll just cut it right now.